is.
There he is.
It's all right. Thanks, Anna. Take your time. It's all right. Don't worry.
It's fine.
Our final case this morning is 823-0767, the City of Minnesota versus James Michael Peterson. As all counsel are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just adjust the microphone to your level, and please begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. James Peterson. Counsel. The issue on this appeal is sufficiency of evidence for the conviction. The framework for this appeal is circumstantial evidence review, on which both parties agree, and that evidence independent of the alleged phone call confession is needed to sustain this conviction on review. Under 634.03, as well as the State v. Hall case, there is ample evidence independent of this alleged confession that under the circumstantial evidence review applicable here, not only raises other inferences that are reasonable than guilt, but many of it points away from guilt. And I would just dwell on those briefly here at the beginning so I can emphasize what I think is important here. I think primarily the testimony of the two witnesses at trial, one of whom, J.M., was looking right at the scene both immediately before and after the shooting. He saw a large SUV. He did not see a small Hyundai that my client was in at the time coming back from the Minute Mart. SJ, I believe, was the other witness who looked out her window right after the shot, saw the same thing. Boater's vehicle, nowhere in sight. Respondent claims in his brief that the shell casing at the scene matched the one found in the garage. Exhibit 64, page 12, says otherwise. The results were inconclusive. The analyst actually thought that the shell casing in Boater's garage didn't even appear to have been made in the same factory. Different tooling, different firearm that it was cycled through.
Would it be fair to say, Mr. Maravilli, that they were similar, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it would.
Which I understand is different from identical and all the rest, but okay.
Well, I'll stick to that point for a bit, since part of my job in my office also deals with forensics, and I do firearm tool mark examination. The fact that an analyst would, I mean, the analyst could have just said that it was inconclusive, which by itself means either one is possible. But the fact that they said it not only couldn't be said that they were cycled through the same firearm, but appears to be different tooling, means a different factory produced the cartridge. So purchased at a different place, moving further and further away from connecting what was in the garage to what was at the scene. The security camera issue, the investigator's opinion that Mr. Boater was hiding from the security camera, I have submitted in my brief, is alternatively explained by the fact that the person that he just dropped off, he had just made a drug deal with, which is just as good a reason to hide from security cameras. The fingerprint on Mr. Nelson's vehicle, the only forensic evidence that was conclusive in this case, matched an individual who was interviewed by police and lied about his whereabouts that night. And finally, I'm ticking through the list that respondent gave
on
page.
Was all of this argued at trial?
Most of it was, not all of it. I'm taking everything from the record, though.
So I just want to pause. I know you're trying to get to your main point, I think, about the reasonable alternative hypothesis. But you are, I think, at this point, on arguing that it is the evidence, circumstantial evidence, is not consistent with guilt. Am I following you?
That is correct, Your
okay.
Honor.
Okay. And that's what, you lose me a bit here, because it seems to me that much of this evidence, if not all of it, because some of it wasn't submitted, but most of it was submitted to the jury. And, you know, if we view this evidence favorable to the jury's verdict, which I think we're still required to do on this,
yes, Your
this,
Honor.
This part of the circumstantial evidence test, I don't see where it doesn't point in the direction of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, this gets to another important aspect of this appeal, and one on which respondent and I have disagreed. Respondent thinks that a large share of this evidence shouldn't be considered at all. So in my reply brief, I have relied on State v. Harmon to point out that this court is obligated to review evidence that is circumstantial and that doesn't necessarily, isn't necessarily consistent with the verdict. Under the test in Harmon, elicited by state witnesses, two, uncontroverted, and three, again, isn't necessarily inconsistent with the verdict. And that applies to all of these facts that I'm relying on, which again, I think the most crucial one is two eyewitnesses seeing a completely different vehicle at the scene and fleeing the scene.
You know, counsel, just your interpretation of that legally doesn't make sense to me, and you have many more years of experience in criminal law than I do, so feel free to enlighten me. But where we have a series of eyewitnesses, some of whom say this, some of whom say that, the jury receives all of that evidence. The fact that there, you know, are some minor detail inconsistencies, I don't think, in my understanding of the circumstantial evidence test, yields the result that you're arguing for, which is that it is inconsistent with guilt. May help you on the other, you know, the last step of the analysis, that reasonable alternative hypothesis, but I'm just missing it, I think.
That is where I also feel I wind up having to go. But I would respectfully remind Your Honor that there were only two eyewitnesses. I mean, if you leave out the surveillance video, there were only two eyewitnesses. They didn't see, neither of them, Boder's vehicle. It wasn't at the scene at the moment that Mr. Nelson was shot. It was not there. The JM witness was pressed on this repeatedly by the prosecutor, and I think he reaffirmed his memory three times during the trial. Plus, it's what he told the police at the scene. It was a large SUV. He saw it in the road right next to Mr. Nelson's truck right before he heard the shot. Now, that is why this uncontroverted evidence is more than just a minor detail. Now, I've also woven in my brief, and again, because of the circumstantial evidence review that is necessary here, the fact that other evidence elicited by the detective showing the timing of Mr. Boder's vehicle coming back, along with this argument that two ear witnesses, RL and CT, I think, heard an argument going on for at least 5 minutes before the shot. Mr. Nelson was shot at 1:47:07. The woman who looked at her clock said that she thought it was around 1:40. We know that Mr. Nelson was on the phone with Ms. Sanford, who was up at the minute mark. He called her at 1:40, and she hung up on him a minute later. The call terminated. I don't know. There's another explanation for that. So he called her back. He was on the phone with her at 1:42 when he said he saw headlights. That's 5 minutes before he was shot. That's three full minutes before Boder's vehicle even turned onto 62nd Avenue, heading south towards his house on the same street. The factual web, if you will, here may be composed of many parts, but it is absolutely critical to analyze these facts, which I would again respectfully urge are not minor. I have never seen a case like this where there is eyewitness, ear witness, and surveillance video evidence that goes completely against the bulk of the state's case provided by Ms. Sanford, who lied on the witness stand about calling Mr. Nelson to warn him. This is also uncontroverted because it was the police who impeached her. She claimed repeatedly that she called him to warn him. She never did any such thing, which either means she didn't care or there was no danger that she was actually concerned about. There are so many inferences to be taken from the rest of the evidence, none of which is direct. I mean, not even the two witnesses who saw the SUV is direct evidence because nobody was looking at the scene right when Mr. Nelson was shot. I grant you that. But for witnesses to be looking at it right after and not see, I mean, the state's whole case and the detective's whole point in his testimony was that Boder was there in his vehicle. According to these two witnesses, no, he was not. And if ever, on appellate review, a review of a conviction has been met with such contrary evidence and the inferences to be drawn with it, I haven't seen it. I would just add that.
So how would we deal with the alleged confession? Would we say, as a matter of law?
You read my mind.
We, as a reviewing court, don't find it credible?
I will grant here at the argument that I must allow that the jury must have believed that. But as I put in my standard of review that 63403 still applies. State v. Hall was cited by a respondent because he literally said the state agrees. There has to be independent evidence of that. And I think that Hall case, once I took a closer look at it, really elaborated on that point to the where it said that the state has to establish evidence that this crime occurred independent of an alleged confession. And I've detailed my concerns about this supposed confession, its timing, its...
Was there independent evidence presented relating to the robbery that took place before the murder?
The only evidence...
Of by the victim against Boder,
The only evidence for that was Ms. Sanford's testimony, which is It's uncontroverted. It also explains the furious texts that she sent to him in the minutes after. I also just found it very bizarre that nobody mentioned the fact at trial that Mr. Nelson actually left the scene. As I put in my brief, it showed him leaving his parking spot at 127, and he didn't come back until 135, about 5 minutes before these headlights showed up and he started arguing with people. So what went on in those seven minutes?
I'm troubled by the confession, but I think I understand your legal argument about that. There's
yes.
Sort of corroboration outside of it. I also understand that you question the credibility of, and I defer to you on how we refer to the central witness, J.S., but her statements about her testimony about what was said by C.B., with regard to this series of events. So a series of comments, probably the most important one of which was that he didn't want her to be present for it, and he wanted the parents' number, TN's parents' number, because somebody needed to know where the body was. I mean, what are we to do with that, counsel?
Those statements, I'm using her name.
Go ahead.
Ms. Sanford herself qualified. During cross-examination, she admitted she didn't actually remember who made the comment about finding the body or...
Well, but she's quite clear about when it happened, and there are only two individuals in the car, and, I don't need to say all of those facts for you. You know them.
But her reasoning is even suspect. I'm sorry, but that I don't think that those statements are things that must be assumed that the jury believed, because those don't go directly to the issue of whether they actually... carried through on this. It's just as likely.
I don't understand that argument.
That
counsel.
Statements like that could have been
really
a joke.
Don't. Yeah.
I mean, if she's saying that Mr. Boder didn't want her to be a witness, then why would he bring a rifle into the car before they even left the house in the first place? That made her a witness, if that actually happened. Now, according to Mr. Peterson, it didn't in his statement to the police. So I think that even those isolated things where Ms. Sanford admitted she didn't remember who made the comment about getting the number and claiming that he wanted to drop her off so she wouldn't be a witness. She already was. If they brought a rifle into the car and were making threats.
That's going outside of what our standard of review will allow us to do. You're making a very passionate jury argument. Could have been very effective, but it's not the circumstantial evidence test that this court deals with.
I understand that.
And just like you acknowledge, we have to accept that the jury credited the confession, we must also accept that the jury credited what Ms. Sanford said. As confusing as it might have been in parts, clearly the jury credited the parts that proved the state's case.
Well, there, I guess I would just respectfully differ by saying that I think that on review, there would have to be credit given to statements attributed to my client, certainly. That's why I'm pointing out that she actually said she didn't remember who made the crack about getting the number. It could have been either of them. And I'll just remind that again, I mean, I cited State v. Silvernail, the Supreme Court opinion, which a comment was made in it that, you know, an alleged confession to a third party who turns into a witness for the state is certainly direct evidence that he made the statement. Mm-hmm. But the justice who wrote that opinion said that it's not really evidence that he did it. But I get that it's about accepting that the jury believed this so-called confession 3 hours later to someone he didn't know. But because of 63403 and State v. Hall, I perhaps wallpapered my brief a little too much as a former trial lawyer with issues that I find with the rest of the evidence that did exist, all of which was circumstantial. And I see I'm out of time. Perhaps that's a good place to end.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jacob Campion. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Minnesota here on behalf of the respondent. This case is not a typical sufficiency of the evidence case, and that's because, as the court knows, the appellant confessed. He put himself at the scene in a confrontation with the victim and admitted that he was the one who shot him. And I think that's why there's been so much effort attacking the credibility of that witness. But as Judge Bradfield pointed out, those are for closing argument. Those are not proper arguments for appeal. And just to address that Silvernail footnote that's been cited and referenced, that's a concurrence. That's not the majority opinion. And the quote is also incomplete. Justice Strauss says, "This type of testimony is arguably direct evidence of the statement, but only circumstantial evidence that the defendant killed the victim," and cite some cases from other jurisdictions. The next line is, "I decline to view the scope of direct evidence so narrowly." And then he goes on to explain, all the jury has to do is find the witness credible, and that's their job, not the appellate court. So it doesn't even support what it's being cited for. And then on this issue about the standard of review, which is really where the parties diverge, about whether to include in the circumstances proved the SUV testimony, testimony about when the argument started and how long it lasted, that testimony should be excluded from the circumstances proved. It can only be included if it's uncontroverted and doesn't contradict the verdict, and neither is true. With respect to the SUV, it's not uncontroverted that the only vehicle was an SUV. There was evidence that one of the witnesses said that Boater's car was the only car in the area. Boater's car is on camera just before the shooting, heading down the street towards the victim's car. Appellant admitted he was in that car. Another witness placed him in that car, and he confessed that he was the one who confronted the victim and shot him. And only the witnesses who saw the end of the altercation, there was only one other car involved besides the victims, and only one car fled the scene. So it's not uncontroverted that the only car was an SUV, and it's not consistent with the verdict to say if the only car was an SUV, then it couldn't be Boater and appellant. Similar for the timing of the argument. Appellant cites witnesses who said it was about 1:40. But we know from the call logs that the victim was on the phone with the main witness until 1:43. And there's no argument going on. And then he says, "I see some headlights." Appellant and Boater arrive at 1:44. So it's not uncontroverted that the argument started at 1:40 before they arrived. Appellant also confessed that he was the one who confronted it, so there's the argument. And the shot was at 147.
Is there evidence that either as to the woman's cell phone or Mr. Maravilli's client's cell phone, that there was conversation between the two of them at that time of night?
Yes, there's an outgoing call. It's in the PowerPoint.
So that at least bolsters that there was a phone call.
There's an outgoing call at 141 from the victim to the main witness, and there's also evidence in the record that lasted at least 2 minutes, which puts it at 143. And then they arrive at 144. And the call ends, again, not an argument going on at this time.
What is the independent evidence, besides the confession, that Peterson was in the car with Boder with a rifle at the time of the shooting?
So you have the main witness who puts them together in the car up until that she is dropped off at the convenience store. Then you have the cameras that trace the car returning, the route that it's returning. And then when it's on the street, there are two lights illuminated inside the car, which the detective testified that appeared to be two cell phones, indicating there were two people in the car.
Does it clearly show that it was Boder's car?
Yes, they testified about, you know, it matches the color. They testified about the rust spots. They testified about the wheels not having hubcaps. There were a lot of markings throughout that testimony where they said this is all consistent with Boder's car. And again, based on the standard of review, we're only looking at the facts that are consistent with the verdict. So we're throwing out the evidence that's inconsistent with it being Boder's car.
So you've got evidence that Boder's car was at the scene. You've got evidence that there was a phone call. What else besides the confession?
So just starting from the beginning, we have the attempted robbery. We have the statement.
Which is based on the woman's testimony.
Correct.
Okay,
Yes, Your Honor. Correct. Direct evidence, personal observation. And then Boder says, we'll take care of it after the fight.
Yeah.
You have Boder
sounds
returning.
Sounds like Boder to me. But I mean, I take it neither Boder nor Mr. Peterson testified.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
They return to the house. They get a gun. An appellant joins at that point. They get in the car. They arrange a meeting with the victim. Boder passes the gun to appellant. They then laugh. It's true. It's not clear in the record who made the statement about do you have the victim's parents' phone number so we can tell them where to find the body. It's not clear who said it, but it is clear that they laughed about that.
Based on her testimony. And then, you never had the gun, right? The actual gun? Or did you?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So, and then the cartridges that were found in the garage, is it fair to say that they could not have come from, that the testimony from the officer or the expert was that they could not have come from the murder weapon?
That's not my recollection of the evidence.
You tell me what he said.
So there was the stamp of the caliber on it. They both had the same caliber stamp on it. There was a symbol on it that was the similar symbol. The report does say, my memory is it said there were not enough markings to say conclusively that it came from the manufacturer, but I don't believe it said that it definitively did not. And then in addition to, you know, what I've been talking so far is direct evidence, and then you start adding in circumstantial evidence of they didn't want the witness present for the confrontation. They tried to avoid cameras and well-lit areas. Then you have his car on camera with the two cell phone lights that I mentioned. The vehicle fleeing the scene, witnesses said it had loud exhaust, which is Bowder's car had a loud exhaust. They stopped at Bowder's house. One of the witnesses said they went down the street and stopped at that house, which is Bowder's house. And then you have the gun case in Bowder's garage with Bowder's DNA on it, similar cartridges that we talked about.
What was the evidence? Was there evidence presented as to what type of gun it was?
There was testimony that it was a long barrel. Okay. The witness initially said she thought it was a shotgun, but said she wasn't sure. It definitely had a long barrel. I believe there's evidence that appellant, when he was talking to law enforcement, said he thought it was an SKS rifle when he was trying to assert that he got dropped off and someone else got in the car with Bowder, and he called it an SKS rifle.
There's a long gun case found at the scene, but no gun. And I mean, you know, what I'm trying to say is there doesn't seem to be anything unique about the gun case that, well, you know, it's only for this type of gun, which we, you know, I mean, lots of guns have long have long barrels. Okay, fine. But there is a gun case, fair enough, that's missing a gun. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, and we're not saying that this is necessarily definitive. It's just one of the evidence that
I think what we are, as Judge Bradfield so eloquently put it, we are trying to figure out all the circumstances consistent with guilt before we get to all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, yeah. Fair enough. Got it. And he is dead. So,
yeah. Yeah. And when you do look at all those circumstances, there just is no reasonable inference other than guilt. And for those reasons, we're asking the court to affirm. I'm happy to answer any further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Miravalli, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, and if I may, the first thing I need to do is correct something about the question you asked. Was there evidence of Ms. Sanford receiving a call? No. At page 405 of the transcript, on direct examination, the prosecutor asked, "So you never took her phone into possession to examine, correct?" And the detective said, "No, I did not." That was extensively asked about at trial. The defense kept pointing out, why didn't you get Ms. Sanford's phone if there was this important call that came from Mr. Peterson at 4:30 in the morning? There is no independent evidence of this call. And I would also like to point out
there's no evidence of cell phone records indicating a call between your client and Ms. Sanford.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
They didn't check Mr. Peterson's phone records either.
But there's testimony about the call records, right?
That is the sole source of the evidence.
Your point is there's no documentary or evidence that is the call record. It is testimony about the call record, correct?
There is no testimony of any kind about a call record because nobody knows what it was. There was just testimony from Ms. Sanford claiming that she got a
call
at 4:30 in the morning. From my client.
Oh, that, okay. I thought you were talking about the earlier time frame when she's talking to...
No.
Yeah, okay, got it.
No,
So you're talking about the confession itself.
What respondent's answer, if I understood it correctly, was again talking about the records they pulled on Mr. Nelson's phone, showing that, yes, he was on the phone with her until 1:43, which, I mean, to me allows that his seeing the headlights happen before one. I mean, it's a minute we're talking about here. There was a 5-minute argument. I mean, the other thing is I think respondent is miscitating the standard here, again, from this court's decision in Herman. The court isn't supposed to exclude from consideration any evidence that contradicts the verdict. Again, if the state elicited, it's uncontroverted, which it is, and it isn't necessarily inconsistent with the verdict, then it applies, as it did in Herman. Now, I have already acknowledged in my brief that the surveillance camera showed Mr. Bowder's vehicle turning onto 67 Avenue, but it wasn't, I mean, it was at 1:44, but it was 1:44:51. It was just about 1:45 when he turned on there, And by the time, and I've noted in my brief that the detective said in his testimony that it appeared that the vehicle had to veer to the left. He said that repeatedly, indicating there was something in the middle of the road, which is consistent with what JM said, that there was a large SUV parked by Mr. Nelson's vehicle. So my point is, I have to admit that Mr. Boder and Mr. Peterson were in the area. The surveillance shows them heading to the house down 67 at 145. Mr. Peterson told the police that he got dropped off, and as he was walking inside, he heard a loud pop. That would have been going on just up around the corner, a block away where Mr. Nelson was. So, I guess in conclusion then, barring any further questions, I'll just restate that my position here is that all of these facts elicited by the state about the SUV, the inconsistent ballistics, or at least inconclusive, the evidence of the argument lasting longer than it would have allowed Boder and Peterson to even be there, these are not insignificant facts, even when compared to the alleged confession. Independent of that confession, they point very solidly away from guilt, or at least to the reasonable inference of something other than guilt, that it was someone else there, which the SUV alone, I'll just say in conclusion, uncontroverted. I mean, JM not only watched it flee the scene, he then got out of his car, walked across Bristol, saw it stop behind some trees for a few minutes, and then he said he saw it head north. I mean, this is the guy holding the Zapruder camera, if you ask me. Such detail, I hope, will not be overlooked as you consider this case. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Campion. Thank you, Mr. Maravilli. That being our last case of the day, we are adjourned. It was nice to see you again, Ms. Maravilli.